Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is freelance writer and editor, Tori Telfer. And we're talking about her new book, Lady Killers, Deadly Women Throughout History. Tori, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
This was an interesting book, and it was a lot more subtle in the way that you wrote about these people than I expected, and I really appreciated that.
I
know you wanted to be very careful in the way that you approach this material, right?
Yes. I didn't want it to be slasher, gore, horror. I didn't want it to be, sort of too salacious or glamorizing these women, which I think a lot of true crime writing, it's easy to fall into because it's so dramatic and you kind of, it's easy to get carried away with the blood and everything, but I appreciate you calling it subtle.
One of the things you write about right at the beginning, there are two essays in this book separate from the biographies of the people involved. Mm-hmm. And those two essays are really fascinating, even though they're not that long. When we think about serial killers, you write, we tend to think about men. And why is that? Is the vast majority of serial killers that we know of men?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a bunch of stats floating around. The one I usually say is it seems like female serial killers make up about 10% of the serial killer population.
That's still a lot of serial killer.
Right. It's not nothing for sure, but and that's if you're counting all the female serial killers carefully, which of course many people only know about Eileen Wuornos. It's just a numbers game, I think, why people mostly think of men, but it's also the image we have of the archetype of the serial killer, I would argue, is like a Ted Bundy, like someone who kills strangers violently. And possibly there's a sexual component there. And female serial killers tend to kill people close to them. They kill people. They don't use physical violence. They'll usually poison, maybe sometimes shoot or stab. Obviously, these things are all violent, but, you know, they're not, like, strangling people.
Right.
Like Ted Bundy did. So, yeah, if that answers your question, I just think our cultural perception of this serial killer is extremely male.
And you
also have these huge famous men, too, on the media, so.
Yeah, and also, as you write also, we tend to have a collective amnesia when we consider female serial killers. It's like we sort of don't want to know that they're there.
Right. The women in my book did achieve some fame when they were caught because it was kind of a freak show fame. People were like, what? She did this? Grandma did this? Then there is this collective amnesia, which is a phrase I can't take credit for. Author Patricia Pearson came up with that. But I think you're right. We don't really want to remember. Like, we want to know what happened. We're curious about it. We want to know all about her. But then culturally, once she's locked up, we don't want to adjust our perception of women to fit her into it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And also you're right about, like, when men consider or confront a female serial killer. And I love the fact that you brought this up because it is true. We want to first check out if she's hot or not. And that's so grotesque, but it's so true. It really is true.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, don't be too hard on yourself. I have the same instinct. Like, we're just so curious if she looks like she could play herself in a movie and, like, fits with Hollywood standards of beauty. Yeah, I think that just part of our larger hypersexualization of women, maybe.
I think so.
And, yeah, I mean, you know, obviously women are always struggling with that. And maybe it's a way to diminish the scariness of a serial killer. You know, if she looks like a pretty girl next door, or if she looks like a, you know, cute tomboy or a... We like to put female serial killers into archetypes, and I think hotness is one way we do that, you know. Is she like a goth witch? Is she a...
Right, exactly.
Right?
Well, you know, and the worst example of that from a person who's in your book is Elizabeth Báthory, who they've made incredibly sort of lurid sexual films about.
Yeah.
And she was a nasty person. There's no, and we'll talk about her in a bit, but but she wasn't like, you know, this hot babe in a bath of blood.
Right. She wasn't like a pinup, like a goth pinup model, which is how people.
It's a, well, you know, I did exactly what you, said in the book. I like Googled,
Googled her.
And by the way, people should do that because it's amazing the kind of images that came up with. It's
right?
Like, yeah. Yeah,
I'm glad that you actually did that.
You were absolutely.
No one's told me that they've done that yet.
No, that you were so right. And as a matter of fact, if you're embarrassed by sexually charged images, don't do it because it's there. But that's the perfect example of that. We sort of sexualize the female serial killer.
Yeah, yeah. In a way that it just bugs me. Like it just. I mean, you know, it's their crimes have nothing to do with sex, unlike male serial killers. You know, most of the women in my book, Ursa Bet might be an exception. We don't know. But, you know, they weren't sexual killers. They weren't like a sexual sadist, like, again, Ted Bundy.
Right.
And so it just seems unfair, if I can use that word, about female serial killers. Like, it just seems unfair to bring their sexuality into the conversation or their hotness. You know, it's like... Well, we're here to talk about crimes and, like, the legal system. Why are we talking about her bathing in a bathtub of blood?
And they also give them a silly nickname.
Yes.
And that's just another way of compartmentalizing it from a male point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that archetype thing again. So, like, the giggling granny.
Yeah, exactly.
One in my book. And, yeah, they're always silly. They're not, like, you know... Jack the Ripper, the Hillside Stranglers, the Night Stalker. Like, these are, like, super terrifying nicknames that male serial killers get that are designed to make us fear them. But are you going to be afraid of the giggling granny?
Right.
Like,
right. Hey, I don't want to phrase this way, but it minimizes their accomplishments.
No, I think you're right.
It makes them also to seem like, oh, they're just like, that's just gals acting weird again.
Right.
And
yeah, exactly.
And when gals in fact they've done some again. Really atrocious things. One of the words that you use to describe what they do, and I want you to explain this in depth, mm-hmm. is hustle.
Great. I love it.
And when I read that, I almost cracked up. I mean, I cracked up and I almost fell off the chair.
Really?
It's like, so yeah. Talk to me about hustling and being a female serial killer.
Okay. So hustle is something I see in a lot of female serial killers. So I'm a freelancer and I frequently use hustle when talking about what I want to be like. Because hustle is a go-getter attitude. Excuse me, what'd you say?
I just said, oh God.
It's like, yeah, I know. I'm a freelance writer, not a freelance, you know, hit woman or anything.
Okay.
But hustle is
But
like
are you
go-getter.
Sexy? That's what I wanted to know. when you're talking hustle, when I read these biographies, it was mm-hmm. interesting because I started to get one over to what I think you mean by hustle, but I need to hear you talk mm-hmm. about it. Okay.
So yeah, it's like that. I'm describing it in broad terms, and then I'll tell you serial killer hustle, go-getter attitude. You know, willing to work multiple jobs, willing to do whatever it takes to get ahead. Just that kind of scrabbling upward that you see in like a cliche would be like. The actor in LA who's a barista and a cater waiter and is eventually going to make it, you know, that's hustle to me. And these women, I mean, they had hustle. Like, not only were they serial killing, but they worked so many side jobs and odd jobs just to make a buck. And they were, many of them, especially the poor ones in the book, were very determined to move up in the world in a way that, you know, is admirable. If you ignore their crimes, which is impossible to do. But, and even they seem to see serial killing, a lot of them seem to see serial killing as another way to move up in the world. So people were either objects to be removed from the path, like, say, a wife. Say you want to marry a rich husband.
Right. Oh, there were several of those.
As an object to remove. Yeah. So they'd kill her.
So,
or... like stepping stones kind of to, right. you know, I don't know. So yeah, does that answer your question? I really,
it does. It does. But it does sort of sound like an admiring term to use for them.
I know. And it's hard to, that's always the trouble I fall into about these women. Cause of course I do not like at all, like okay. condone what they do or admire them, but I still want to humanize them just because they were humans. And there are certain things about them that are more empathetic than others. And I think the hustle is one. Like,
well, often the women who are in sort of dire straits and mm-hmm. then their only way to be upwardly mobile was to yeah. murder is sort of one kind of a situation.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about the economics of this. And that was one of the things that I realized. Sure. There were those women on that end of the economic scale. Mm-hmm. And then there were people like Elizabeth Báthory and Dania mm-hmm. Nikolaevna you're going to have to pronounce that name. Now, that was economics and abuse from the other end of the economic scale. These are people who are incredibly privileged to the point that they thought these people were disposable.
Yes. Those women are both great examples of how power corrupts and how power can be abused. Yes, they both killed their servant girls. And not only did they personally clearly seem to think that servants were truly a lesser life form and thus disposable, but both of them, Erzsébet in 1500s Hungary and Daria in 1700s Russia, both of them lived in times when the legal system and sort of like the moral code of the upper classes supported them. Like no one was approving of their actions, but the law certainly was on their side in both cases. So they're kind of like terrifying and extreme examples of what happens when you really marginalize a whole type of people and really crush them down and take away their legal rights and then,
right.
you know, birth a few.
Oh, I think both of those stories were horrific because they didn't just kill the servant girls. They ended up torturing them like for long periods of time and then just sort of did away with them and then would like cast their bodies to the wolves or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it just really sort of reflected an attitude of privilege mm-hmm. towards the servant classes that was frightening. That was absolutely and oftentimes these people would only get caught when they finally went a little bit too far and like would kill somebody who actually had money, and then people started like looking into it.
That's such a theme. That's like a common thread between so many serial killers is, you know, a lot of them are pretty smart people, pretty savvy criminals, and then they get a little confident, they get a little cocky, and they kill someone who's more important than their average victim. You see that in The Benders, too.
Yep.
Maybe we'll talk about that. But, you're totally right. They could have hypothetically gone on forever, but then they're like, maybe I'll try to kill a noble girl today. And then, of course, can't do that.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is freelance writer and editor Tori Telfer. And we're talking about her new book, Lady Killers, Deadly Women Throughout History. Well, let's talk, you know, you mentioned The Benders. That's an interesting story because of what happened at the end, especially, too. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about Kate Bender, but it was actually sort of a family operation, wasn't it?
Yes. The Benders were maybe a family, maybe not, but they certainly appeared to be a family. And they sort of showed up in Kansas in the 1870s from somewhere out east. They were German immigrants, but they wouldn't say anything about their past. And they set up a little roadside inn and began killing their rich guests who were headed out west to claim land, so would have had their whole life savings on them. I mentioned serial killers being smart earlier. I mean, it was a diabolically perfect plan.
Right.
Because these guests had their money on them, and they were so far from their homes back east that by the time, you know, I mean, there was just no one looking out for them. You know, their families back home weren't expecting to hear from them for months. So there was just like no way of tracking these men, and which is why the Benders killed for about 2 years without being detected, and then killed a rich man who lived nearby and had a senator for a brother. And that was how it all, you know, started unraveling for them.
But I want to talk about the unraveling part, because do we really know what happened to them?
We do not, which is, I love it about the Bender story, because it's like truth being more poetic than fiction. They vanish into the sunset of the Wild West. Basically what happened is, you know, so they kill this important man, and then his important brothers come looking for him, and the Benders feel the water heating up around them, so to speak, and they're like, oh, come back tomorrow, and you can look all around our farm. And when the guys come back, the Benders have vanished. And basically they hopped on a train, the short train that would have led them to a hub where they could have gone north, south, east, or west. So they totally vanished, but they became myth almost right away. So people reported seeing them all over the U.S., in Havana, in Paris.
Wow.
And the paranoia, because the people of Kansas were extremely, not only disgusted by the crimes, but they felt slighted and embarrassed that it had happened and they hadn't noticed and the Benders had gotten away with it. So, you know, there was like this intense public need to find them, which is why I think they kind of like popped up like mirages. And people would even capture fake Benders, so to speak, and like throw them in jail for a night or play them at a theater.
Well, the other thing you brought up is that there were all these fake stories about how she met her end. Mm-hmm. And one of the points you bring out is that some of them have these really sort of violent, sexualized content to them, which is really revealing about how people think about these things.
Yeah. So Kate is the daughter, of course. She was about 25. And yeah, there were all these stories popped up about men who claimed to kill the Benders. And so many popped up that I think we can safely say that none of them are true. It was almost like a collective cultural fantasy. And yes, these men, in every story, Kate is the one that's hardest to kill. It often takes more than one man to kill her. And there is a sexual, violent, kind of pinning her down component that is disturbing. And you're exactly right. It says way more about the culture than it does about Kate, because, you know, Kate's laughing off in California by then or whatever. But it shows just how much people wanted vengeance, and like how this was a rare moment when it was okay to express that type of
right.
desire.
This was the license to do that.
A license to do that, exactly.
The thing that I kept thinking about is, are there people who are descendants of the Benders, therefore, are around?
Sorry, continue.
I keep thinking that there's probably descendants walking among us.
Yes, I think that too.
Now, you cried twice while working on this book, and I'm going to talk to you about it, because it's a fascinating story. It was on the chapter with somebody that was nicknamed Iceberg Anna. Talk about who she was. It's Anna Marie Hahn.
Yes. Anna Marie Hahn was a woman who killed in the 1930s in Cincinnati, and she is kind of your classic psychopath. She was German, and she would target elderly German men who were alone. So, you know, again, that theme of no one's looking for the victims. And she would convince them that she was kind of like their girlfriend and then poison them. And it just real cold-hearted, cruel behavior. And that's where she got the nickname Iceberg Anna. And she was the first woman to get the death penalty, I think, in the state. And when I cried both times was when I was editing her chapter and working on the ending, which is her walk to the electric chair, because she completely lost it. The warden of the prisoner said he'd never seen an inmate so terrified to die. She had to be dragged to the chair. She was begging and pleading. And, like, I have conflicted feelings about that, because part of me is angry, because it's like, oh, now you realize that it's scary to die. You've done this to so many people. But, I guess I cried just because it shows, it's like you can be the coldest psychopath in the world and take lives, but then it just shows this like animal desire within us all to live. And there's just something moving to me about that.
I want to talk to you about poisoning, because that's a big theme in a lot of these stories. Why was poisoning, especially with arsenic, so popular, and it's a long haul to the grave being poisoned by arsenic. Yeah. It's a nasty way to die.
It's a terrible way to die. It gets a bad, quote unquote, bad rap for being like this easy weapon.
Oh no.
It's a vicious way to kill someone. Yeah. So poisoning is the female serial killer's weapon of choice. Like for sure. I would say like 80%, maybe more. And I mean, arsenic was just so common back in the day, especially if you were a woman, you could get it in cleaning products. You could have it in your kitchen to kill rats. It was just like
It was called rough on rats.
It's called rough on rats at one point. Yeah, it was just there. So it wasn't hard to get, as opposed to like, I don't know what would be hard to get, like some sort of, vintage hunting rifle.
It was around the house.
It was around, yeah.
And your husband was giving you,
giving you the roll in the eyes, and your coffee was too weak. And you look over and see the rough on rats.
And, it's just a short trip from the counter to the cup. The thing is, you die over a long period of time. And you were talking about viciousness. Like, you stab or shoot somebody, they may suffer, and that's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But you suffer for months, and it's horrible suffering. It's like massive diarrhea and stomach pains and all sorts of – you describe the way these people die, and it's just bad.
Yeah, I think the worst symptom is you just feel like your insides are on fire. So you have all these victims just like crying out for water, and it's heartbreaking. And I think you have to be a particular brand of psychopathic to fake nurse someone for months as you're slowly poisoning them. Like, that's so deranged to me. And, people think, here I am comparing ways to murder, maybe. But people think it's so much scarier, these male serial killers who jump out of the woods and strangle you or whatever. Not that that's not utterly terrifying, but it's like, okay, come on. Like, your wife wiping your fevered brow for months while she's poisoning you, like, that is so monstrous.
And you probably suspect
monstrous.
It. You probably suspect it after a bit. You probably realize that she's doing it.
Yeah.
And now you're so weak you can't get out of bed.
Right, you must. And there is one man in the book who, from the Marianne Cotton chapter, her lover said, someone said something about a fever, and he said weakly, "It is no fever I have." And I was like, he knows it's her.
I once interviewed a chemist who wrote a book about poisoning, and he said he actually described the golden age of poisoning. It was like the latter half of the 1800s into the early 1900s. And apparently everybody was poisoning. I mean, poisoning was like, it was the way to go. And people didn't test closely for it. And so, and people died from a lot of other stuff. So why not die from arsenic?
Right. That's hilarious that it had a golden age.
I know. Isn't that weird? That was a term he used. It was bizarre. Now, there's a really wonderful phrase that you use when you talk about these women, when you remember these women. It's mise en abîme. In the middle of the abyss, placed in the abyss. Talk about that phrase. That's a beautiful phrase.
Thank you. Yeah, I can't remember where I stumbled across it, but it was near the end of working on this book, and I was like, whoa, that reminds me of these women. It means placed into the abyss. It's kind of like, I get the vibe of being in like a hall of mirrors, sort of endlessly refracting and going on forever, but also sort of trapped. And I think about it, especially in for these richer killers who we were talking about, and for like Anna Marie Hahn, the psychopath who didn't want to die. It's just this, like, I get this sense from them that they were flailing, they couldn't control their actions in a way, which I think is a lot of serial killers have this like shadow self that they can't control. They were very lonely people. Like, serial killers are not happy people, obviously. And there's something just tragic about.
Wait a minute.
The whole thing is so tragic. I'm not sympathizing with them.
Nanny Doss was sort of happy.
You're right. Nanny Doss had a great time serial killing.
She was enjoying the whole thing.
She was a pleasant lady.
She was a pleasant serial killer.
A pleasant. She
was, as serial killers go, she was pleasant.
Yes. If you had to get coffee with one, you might want Nanny Das because she would make some good jokes.
She really would. And she was nice. She'd, you know, she, oh my God. We're almost out of time, but the one case that I thought was sort of weird was Alice Keteller. Is it Keteller?
Yeah, Keteller.
Now, in that case, here's a woman who was tried as a witch. How can we even be sure that she did anything?
How can we be sure that she did?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm always a suspect when I read about witchcraft cases that basically she was railroaded.
And So she was in the 1300s, so admittedly, it's a lot, you know, we're just guessing here. But the reason I included her is because I think she had all the signs of the classic black widow serial killer who profits from each death. She killed, I think, 4 husbands and got a lot of money from each one. So, no, we have no forensic evidence, of course, or anything, but people were suspicious of her. People seemed to know that something was going on, and her stepchildren were so suspicious of her that they brought a charge of witchcraft against her, which at the time was kind of how people dealt with these sorts of suspicions.
Oh, wow.
So I feel pretty confident that she was like a very early serial killer, but admittedly, it's me making a educated guess and pretending I'm an FBI agent.
I think she's innocent, but we're going to leave it there. There's a lot talk about, and you should really read this book. There's an awful lot of research in this. My guest tonight has been freelance writer and editor Tori Telfer. We've been talking about her book, Lady Killers, Deadly Women Throughout History. There's going to be like a rough on rats. Trust me, after reading this book, everybody's going to be looking for that. Tori, it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You've been listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.